core of the Buddha's teachings is the intention to end all suffering. And this retreat will address the harmful treatment inflicted on many people due to their ethnic lineage, skin color, gender, gender identity, sexual orientation, religion, age, and physical or mental afflictions and disabilities. Owning our identities and learning to love who we are just as we are is essential. At the same time, we have to learn to embrace the Buddha's teachings that nothing whatsoever should be clung to as I or mine. That is the necessity of letting go of everything, including constructed identities. The retreat that I came out on in the summer of 2017, I was in a small group interview with a very skilled and experienced Dharma teacher named Kamala Masters. And I was in the group, I was kind of wrestling with the complexity of my karma that it, you know, I'd been gender fluid inside, it'd been a secret I kept just about all my life. And then I finally just decided that I didn't want to die in the closet. It wasn't a secret that I wanted to have to take to my deathbed and wanted to start owning the truth of my identity. But it felt problematic and really pretty scary. And I was kind of, I don't know, probably whining about my karma a little bit. She said, oh no, she said, it's very good karma. She said, you have the ability to experience both gender identities while also understanding that all identities are illusory. And so how do you hold that? You know, for people who've been marginalized in our society, there is real importance and real value in owning who we are, standing up for ourselves, you know, making it clear that everybody is deserving respect, you know, and that we do terrible harm to each other when we allow these certain biases or prejudices to take over. And yet at the same time, at the end of the day, literally, or at the end of life, you know, the Buddha tells us we really need to let go. So how do we hold both those things? How do we honor both of those perspectives? You know, the relative and the absolute. So that's what we decided we wanted to focus this retreat on. So we're going to be doing some sitting practice, some guided meditations. We're also going to be doing some small group work, and some inquiry into these questions and the relationship between these two views of identity on that retreat. And I think a flyer is circulated electronically. I'll try to make sure that we have hard copies of the flyer back there on the table as well. So any questions about that one?
What's the date?
The dates are May the 25th and 26th. That's a Saturday and a Sunday from 9 to 5 at the Naropa University Nalanda campus in Boulder. Okay. And in the line of doing more teaching, the other thing I wanted to make note of is a retreat that I'm going to be co-leading with our very own Sarah here in the Sangha. And it's combining mindfulness meditation and restorative yoga. A few years ago, I did a similar workshop with a restorative yoga teacher named Robin Thorpe. I think some of you may have attended that. So we're basically offering a workshop along similar lines to what we did with the same intention. You know, yoga is, I suppose, probably my principal mind-body practice that I do in addition to the meditation. And at least what I've come to learn over the years, at least one of the ancient intentions underlying yoga was the realization that periods of long sitting meditation are not necessarily a kindness to the body. And that there needs to be some means of being actively kind to the body to make it possible to sit in meditation. So practices that have to do with opening channels of energy, relaxation, kind of surrendering to the energies of the universe that flow through us is very, very consonant with the practice of mindfulness meditation. The two really kind of feed each other and undergird each other in an interesting way. So Sarah, is there anything you'd like to add about, you know, about our workshop?
Just that I had that workshop with Lloyd and Robin a few years ago, and as I was there, I was thinking how much I would love to be able to teach a workshop like that. And now I am. And yoga has always been a practice for me that has helped remind me that the body is what is always in the present moment. And yoga has been really helpful to, and meditation has been very important in helping me to realize that and understanding thoughts and feelings that I have and how they influence my body, how my body influences my thoughts and my feelings. And yoga has been instrumental in teaching me that. So I'm really grateful to be getting to share that with you all and teaching the boy. And we'll just be at Whole Yoga, which is about 3 or 4 blocks away on 17th and Williams. There's room for 20 people. We have 3 more slots. And we'd love to have a wait list. So please pick up a flyer and or ask me any questions you'd like.
Very well. Thanks, Eric. Yes, please.
What's the date?
June 8th, in the afternoon, is a 3-hour workshop.
Mm-hmm. Half day. It's a Saturday. Okay, anything else that would like to be announced, please?
Well, this is an announcement of a retreat at Vallecitos Mountain Retreat Center, September 20th to 26th. Peter Williams, I don't understand what his word is, Charles D. Capua?
Yeah, Charles D. Capua.
Charles D. Capua? Mm-hmm. Assisted by J.D. Doyle. And I will leave this on the table over there.
Very good.
Okay. In the interest of engaged Buddhism and the Buddhist-Christian dialogue, Father Roy Bourgeois will be in town. Father Roy I think he's 80 years old now, and he's been working all his life trying to do social justice and working for oppressed peoples. He's going to be here Thursday, May 2nd. He's going to be at the American Friends Service Committee office at 1420, now I'm forgetting the street, Franklin, I think, I'm sorry. But you can, if you look up, if you see me later, we can look it up on my phone. He'll be speaking from 6 to 8 o'clock there, and this is in collaboration with the Denver Justice and Peace Committee and the local Denver American Friends Service Committee, which is the Quaker outreach and the Quaker community that does that also practices meditation in their worship, Mountain View Friends meeting. So, Father Roy is a real treat. He's wise. He's humble. He's funny. He has a word to offer. So I hope. If you have any questions, you can see me after, and we'll look it up on the phone to be sure you get the right place.
The date was May 22nd.
May 2nd, coming. This coming Thursday.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jen. Thanks. Okay, this evening is the third and final installment in a series that I've been offering and that we've been working with over the last month or so, on the three meditative factors in the Eightfold Path. You know, as depicted in the Dharma Wheel, we have the meditative factors of wise effort, concentration, and mindfulness, and then the wisdom factors of wise or skillful understanding of the nature of mind in Buddha Dharma, and insight into intention, and then the three fruition factors of wise speech, action, and way of life. So I want to spend this evening again putting this third of the meditative factors, mindfulness, into the context of that set of three, and looking at it with a little more care. And necessarily, my comments this evening and are really influenced by my current study into the topic, and my understanding and my practice experience, including the retreat that I recently went on, which I'll be incorporating some of into our talk, into my talk and our discussion. So I wanted to preface this evening's talk with a few reflections on mindfulness meditation practice as taught within the context of Buddha Dharma, both in Asia and here in the West, as distinguished from its application in secular environments. Mindfulness meditation was a practice that existed in the time of the Buddha prior to his enlightenment. It's a practice that he learned prior to his experience of living in a state of nirvana. Although it was practiced for somewhat different reasons in the Brahmanic context than the Buddhist one, was nonetheless already a technique that was known, that was out and about. As used in the secular context here in the West, it's primarily for the purposes of stress reduction. And a lot of that has emanated from some really pioneering work done by a meditator named Jon Kabat-Zinn at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center, where he was able to establish a pain management clinic for people who had not been able to find other medical means of treating, or in some cases even being able to withstand chronic and ongoing pain. He was trained by some of the same teachers I was. So he was trained in mindfulness meditation as taught by the Buddha and for the purposes of cessation of suffering. But in the secular format, it's kind of like the secular presentation of yoga practices in the West, you know. Chances are in most yoga classes you will not come across the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. And one of the ancient pioneering founders of the practice of yoga. And so it is with mindfulness in the secular context. At the retreat I was on, this discussion arose about, and views offered by the monk, the teacher, as to, you know, whether there was more harm than good being done by the secular practice of yoga, and frankly, its commodification. And he basically said, well, you know, there may be upwards of 1 million people, or maybe or more perhaps now, watching their breathing and becoming more mindful of their speech and their actions before uttering them. And he said, I can't help but think that our society is better off for that being the case than if it had never been introduced. Which I could clearly understand, and that's been, you know, generally speaking, my own view as well. That being said, after this retreat, when I was on my way home, I was driving through Marin County, you know, Fairfax and San Anselmo, and these really wealthy, high-end places. I was just, it just kind of started to get to me, you know. And I saw signs for things like, you know, mindful endings, you know, like mindful manicure and pedicures, mindful massage, you know, mindful herbals, which was a pot shop. And it just started to just kind of wear me down a little bit, you know, weigh me down. And so I was in a, you know, health food market the other day getting ready to check out, and on the magazine rack there is this, I think it was a edition of Yoga Magazine or something, and there was this very attractive young Caucasian woman, you know, in a half lotus with a blissful smile on her face saying, the mindfulness edition, you know, and I wanted to punch it out. It struck me and it disturbed me in a way that surprised me, I guess I could say. And then when I was with friends in the East Bay afterwards, you know, Dharma teaching friends and folks that had been on this retreat that I had just been on, we were sharing what the nature of our experiences was. And some close friends in the Bay Area, their son is an extraordinarily experienced meditator. He's done many, many long retreats. He's an expert body worker. He's done studies of Buddhist psychology and the impact of Buddhist meditation practices on on the mind. And he makes quite a good living in the Bay Area as a stress management coach. And his clientele consists mostly of these quite well-to-do dot-comers, you know, mostly in their 20s and 30s, who are earning a lot of money, but who are working 60 or 70 hours a week, and so they don't have a lot of places to spend it. And so one of the things they spend it on is trying to reduce the incredible toxic amounts of stress that they endure on the job, you know? And so he works with them, and he does body work with them, does breathing awareness work, individual training and doing mindfulness meditation practices, for which they're supremely grateful and are able to get brought down and relax and opened up so they can go back to work the next Monday and start all over again. And I think that this is a good jumping off point for looking more closely at the distinction between Buddha Dharma in the secular context and that in the Buddha Dharma context. Yeah. So some very skillful uses of Buddha Dharma of mindfulness meditation in the realm of pain management, for instance. You know, highly secularized, not mentioned of Buddhism, but still nonetheless a very effective pain management technique. As a stress management technique, you know, the case could be made that it's become something of a workplace opioid in the corporate world, a way to chill out workers so they can manage the incredible amounts of stress that their job is laying on them. You know, Don Morale and I, many years ago, each respectively spent time teaching mindfulness meditation to the inmates at the federal men's medium security prison out in Inglewood. And one of the reasons that prison authorities seemed to think it was okay to do that was because of the effect on the inmates insofar as anger management was concerned. You know, they were less likely to whack each other or engage in unskillful behaviors of one kind or another because they were able to see clearly into what was arising in the mind that was causing them to get in so much trouble. I know they're hugely beneficial. And of course, in that context, we're actually able to talk about Buddha Dharma, so that made it easier. And in trying to think through this, I was reminded of this quotation from Dom Helder Camara, who was a Brazilian archbishop and liberation theologian. He said, "When I ask for food for the poor, they call me a saint. When I ask why the poor have no food, they call me a communist." So I think the problem that we're starting to arise, you know, with mindfulness and perhaps in the corporate environment, is that it seems to avoid having a closer look of what's wrong with the workplace that inflicts such damaging levels of stress in the first place. That maybe the way we treat each other in organizations, including for-profit ones, could use a closer look rather than just taking the hits and trying to deal with their effects on an individual basis. So again, it goes to the question of intention. So mindfulness within the context of the Buddha's teachings it goes along so nicely with the other two meditation factors, you know, what's kind of awkwardly called right concentration, which is a kind of small s meaning of the word samadhi, a more articulated translation of which is tranquil, focused, sustained attention. So for instance, if you think about, let's say if you have a pair of binoculars or a camera with a long lens, and you're trying to look at something that's a long ways away, if you don't hold the device really steady, it jumps around a lot. And so you can't get a real clear image of what it is you're trying to look at. And that's a simile for the nature of the relationship between samadhi and sati, between concentration and mindfulness. What you want to do is to calm the mind to the point where you can clearly see what it is you're trying to observe, so you can avoid the mental jiggling that makes it not possible to really take in what it is you're trying to be mindful of. Relationship between mindfulness and wise effort is an invitation to examine the nature of our effort, why it is that we're doing what we're doing. Okay. All too often we find that the meditation effort is one of trying to make something different than it is. Maybe make ourselves different than we are, you know. I want to have more peace of mind. I don't want to be as angry or as anxious as I am. I want more happiness in my life. So we do the practice out of a sense of dissatisfaction, okay, or maybe even a certain amount of self-aversion. That's not very skillful effort. Because it has the effect of setting up this tension between who we think we are and who we think we want to be. Instead, the practice is one of coming into more and more complete acceptance of who we are, of everything we are. The full catastrophe, as Zorba the Greek used to call it. John Kabat-Zinn's first book is called Full Catastrophe Living. You know, how do we open up to everything that's there rather than tossing out any part of it? An analogy to the practice of sati or mindfulness that the teacher on this meditation retreat is Bhante Analayo is one that I'm finding to be really, really useful. And his simile has to do with the intention and the state of mind that we bring to doing mindfulness meditation practice in the first place. So just as in the Metta Sutta, the Buddha says, just as a mother protects her child, her only child, with her life if need be, so too should we cherish all living beings, you know, radiating unobstructed loving kindness to all, suffusing the entire world with unobstructed loving kindness. He says, again reiterates that sati is a Pali is a genderized language. Sati is a female noun. The practice of sati is a female verb, he said. A useful simile is that of a mother at the playground with her kids. You know, she wants them to play and interact with each other kids and to learn about the environment, learn about their own capabilities. But yet at the same time, she doesn't want them to get hurt. A few years ago, I co-authored a book with a law professor at from Brigham Young University in Utah, and several school districts throughout the state. They did this very interesting experiment where they had grade school kids, first, second, third graders, learn Mandarin as one of their subjects. I think that this ran up through about the fourth grade or so, when they were still pretty young. The kids just really seemed to take it up, and the ones that were studying Mandarin also seemed to do much better at all their other subject areas. And so then she had an opportunity for a sabbatical, and they went off to China for a half year or so, so she could work at some legal research institute in Beijing. So I asked her, you know, if she picked up any Chinese along the way, and she said, well, not too much, you know. In interacting with my kids, I learned to say things like, stop hitting your sister, and eat your vegetables. And she said, those phrases didn't come in real handy at the Legal Research Institute. But it's kind of that attitude, you know, looking at the kids. You don't want them to harm themselves and do foolish things. You don't want them to harm others, right? This is also very stereotypical uses of gender, of course. You know, I've known moms over the years who were strung out junkies, drunks, couldn't take care of themselves, much less their children. I've known fathers who were kind and patient and compassionate and loving, you know, all the kinds of qualities we normally ascribe to the feminine. But what he was trying to get across is that you're not just practicing mindfulness like a security camera, that all rests on the tip of intention, like the Tibetans say. You know, you really need to pay attention to the quality of care and intention that you bring to the practice of mindfulness. So you you give the kids, as you know, the kids being the different things that come up in the mind. You know, you're there with them in this, like this Buddha field, this playground, this activity, or this arena of activity. You know, one of the stories I like about when these meditation practices in particular were first finding their way into China, and there was a monk trying to teach the Chinese emperor how to do mindfulness practice. Just wasn't getting it through words, and so he had this, he caused to be constructed this circular room made up of facing mirrors, 16 facing mirrors. And then he had the emperor stand in the middle of it and said, who do you see? He said, in every direction I see myself, and in every direction I see infinity. So one way to think about mindfulness meditation is that we are the mirrors, right? We are the loving consciousness that is looking in on everything that's going on. And so if we see the mind about to inflict pain on itself or others, you know, we can step in and take action. You don't just sit there and watch the kid fall off the monkey bars and get a concussion, you know, or whack some other kid in the head with a tree branch or something and give them a concussion. You step in, you intervene, you keep that from happening. But other than that, you simply be with whatever's going on in the mind in a loving and supportive way. And then gradually it becomes more and more clear what activities of mind are skillful and which ones are not. So just as you train a child, that's not appropriate. You know, you really shouldn't behave that way. Behave this way instead and see how much happier you'll be and how many more friends you'll have. And how much more you'll enjoy being here. So in terms of our own intention in practicing in mindfulness, that's what we're about. And then we can turn the attention to, as the Buddha suggested, to mindfulness of what we were doing, mindfulness of breathing. As you may have noticed, that's a fairly powerful concentration practice, isn't it? You may have noted that over time your breathing got a little slower and a little deeper. Became more possible to see the thoughts or the emotions when they arose, okay, because the mind was calm and could see clearly. So we become more mindful of breathing in the body. We can become more mindful of the arising of thoughts and emotions. We can become more mindful of how the mind responds to those stimuli, whether we adjudge a physical feeling to be pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. Whether we adjudge a thought or an emotion to be pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. Okay. And at this point, the actual content of mind are the various phenomena that arise that we look at. They become less important than the underlying intention of kind regard that we bring to doing the practice in the first place. So, and Tibetan Book of the Great Liberation on Hearing in the Bardo, there's this advice given to the person whose life is ending. Step out of the small self, this body of fear, and rest in generosity and kindness of heart. Rest in the dedication and equanimity and compassion that you share with all life. For that is who you truly are. Trust it and rest in your own true nature. It's that same mind state, you know, relaxing into the peace of the now, you know, that is the most skillful means of doing mindfulness meditation, you know, which is to do this practice as a kindness to oneself, to do this practice as a gesture of goodwill, to do this practice as a gift that one friend might give to another. Okay, so nice work if you can get it. And if you do, let me know how. So let's have some reflections, some exchange of ideas. Any thoughts or questions that anyone has, this is a good time to share them. Please, Don.
When you were talking earlier about sort of mindfulness, you know, mindful nail polishing and so on, I was reminded of something. I read an article that appeared in Time magazine about Thich Nhat Hanh, who has gone back to Vietnam to die, essentially.
Yes, yes.
And it said in the article that he was one of the founders of a $1.8 billion industry in America. That blew me away. That just really blew me away. I mean, why does Time magazine think it's important? Because it's a $1.8 billion business. Yeah. And to a certain extent, I think in the West, we've kind of blown it. Do you know what I'm saying? I think we have blown it in many ways around the presentation of the Dharma. You know, in Asia, it's alms mendicancy. And if nobody puts anything in your bowl, you don't eat. That's essentially it.
Yeah.
But the villagers feel like, you know, it's a reciprocal arrangement.
Yes, right.
And I feel that maybe we've lost our way in the West and that we need to kind of step back from that kind of spiritual materialism.
Oh, yeah, it's obviously it's rampant, you know.
Yeah.
Trungpa wrote a whole book about it, you know, cutting through spiritual materialism. It wasn't about mindfulness necessarily, but it was about the commodification of Buddha Dharma.
Right.
You know, and how we bring that same grasping attitude toward this as anything else. I'm a little less inclined to indict efforts to share Buddha Dharma in the West solely on the basis of the fact that, you know, mindfulness meditation has been commodified. You know, this culture is shameless when it comes to, you know, it's like anything to make a buck, right?
Yeah.
And so anything that people find useful, and I've also heard Dharma teachers that are, you know, when Joseph and Sharon and Jack and others were coming back here in the 70s to start teaching the Dharma, they were hesitant at first. They each asked their teachers, do you think I'm ready? Do you think that, you know, I've only been sitting with you for a few years, do you think I actually ought to go back to the West and start teaching the Dharma? And their teachers all actively encouraged them to do so. you know, like Munindraji and Ajahn Chah and Buddhadasa and others. But the one thing that they all asked is, please just don't sell the Dharma. Yeah, because they knew that it was of great value. And by that time, you know, here back in the States in the 70s, there were all kinds of teachers coming here from Asia, each with something different to say, some of whom set up little fiefdoms over here and set up basically cults and got very wealthy and then usually wound up doing terribly unskillful things and it all collapsed. And so they were acutely aware that even as, you know, and those of us back in the 70s who were really deeply engaged in this stuff, it really was countercultural, you know, and in the same way that the Buddha described Buddha Dharma. It's countercultural, it's against the grain, it's against the stream. And so, and I think that may be what you're getting at, you know, which is to say, you know, the problem with using mindfulness as an opioid, which I think really has, you know, along with the commodification, has really begun to occur to an unfortunate extent. But I can sure hear what you're saying in terms of, you know, is there a way we could have been truer than we were to the Buddha's original intentions insofar as trying to resist the commodification is concerned? For me, it's an ongoing thing, you know, it really is. We don't charge in this particular tradition the way some others do. You know, they're like monthly dues, and you don't pay, you're not part of the Sangha. You know, and they have a lot more retreat centers and, you know, only own property and uniforms and titles and stuff. This is much more low-key, do-it-yourself Dharma, for sure. It's also, as you point out, held differently in Asia as well. I think it's treasured to a greater degree and receives more spontaneous public support because of that. But, you know, the future is not yet written. We'll have to see how things continue to unfold. I think it's something for us all to stay mindful of, you know, to try to do what we can to, I mean, secular mindfulness is going to do what it's going to do, and pretty soon it's going to probably fade and there'll be something else come along, and then those who found their lives were really changed might come back and try to study it from a different point of view, one that's more grounded in Buddha Dharma. All comes back to intention, doesn't it? Yeah. Please.
Yeah. My comment is that I don't know if other people have found that with the more secularization of it, that people kind of have an expectation of me and how I'm going to be. They know I have a long practice, so they're like, but you were calm in this one position, or you stood up and, you know, did something against the stream and spoke up in a certain way, which to me felt like, if I could do that very skillfully, depending on the thing. But it's interesting to see with that what people's expectations are of us as practitioners, as somewhat willing to put up with anything or a little bit more passive, where, so I appreciate you saying like, oh, I had this reaction where I wanted to punch it. Because, you know, I've had those, you know, we have those things. We have the full range of emotions. And so I just, that's my comment, is with the popularity, there seems to be an expectation from the outside of how we as practitioners may act.
Yes, absolutely. And just as you correctly point out, somehow this anticipation or expectation that we ought to be above it all and be serene and not get too engaged with what's going on. One of the most fascinating things for me about this retreat that I just came off of, you know, which is taught, you know, led by this very skilled and deeply knowledgeable scholar of and translator of Buddhist texts, both out of Pali and out of the classical Chinese, and also a practicing monk, that in some ways there was really this sense that this was about as traditional as it gets, since, and we were doing things where we were sitting for indeterminate periods of time, not chopped up into sitting and walking periods. Samadhi getting very deep. And on the last day of the retreat, and he was giving teachings during the day, throughout the retreat, on the last morning of the retreat, he said, "This morning I want to talk about climate change." He said, "It's been said that this is not an appropriate topic for the Dharma Hall." He said, "In my view, there is no more appropriate venue to speak of these matters." And we spent, and he gave teachings on relating the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness to mindful action with regard to what he perceives as the greatest environmental crisis in the history of humankind. And so we had this wonderful, rich discussion after his teachings that went on for about 2 hours or so, that I think was really, I don't know, for me, it certainly woke me up to the need for, that I want to bring that realm of focus and activity much more back into our Sangha than it has been for a while. But also, he was really going after possibilities. He said, you know, the purpose of this practice is not to just sit around like chickens on a roost, you know. Doing this practice transforms the mind. It transforms your consciousness. It transforms the way you understand how your mind works, how others' minds works, what is an appropriate relationship with others, what is an appropriate relationship with the environment, what it means to live an ethical life with regard to the care for all living beings. He said, that's a huge charge. That's not apart from the practice of Buddhist meditation. That's the fruition of the practice of Buddhist meditation. And as far as he was concerned, it's like we were all charged to do what we can to use the transformation in consciousness to whatever degree we feel that we may have experienced it to alleviate suffering in the world. You know, to not only follow the path of the Arahant, but also the path of the Bodhisattva. You know, to really dedicate ourselves to compassionate action to the extent that we feel that we can do so wisely, you know, without devolving into dualism and conflict. To the extent we can do it wisely, compassionately, with kind regard for ourselves and others, that it basically is at this moment of crisis in the history of our, you know, the planet. It's what we're called upon to do. There's work to be done out there. And I think getting back to Don's comment, you know, I think we may not have blown it if we can see clearly a means by which we can use whatever changes Buddha Dharma has wrought in our own lives, in our own consciousness, in our own well-being, in our own relationship with others, that perhaps to a greater extent than any other in our history at this time, the time has really come to put that into action. We spent a fair amount of time on the retreat also meditating on various things the Buddha suggested, like death. And so one of the comments that came up, you know, that for some time now, those who really do not want public attention to be focused on climate change have been using hate and fear as motivators. You know, first to say it's not really going on, and anyone who tells you this is just trying to flip you out, and then going from denial to basically actively fomenting despair, which is to say it's too late, there's nothing to be done. You know, so you might as well go ahead and continue to burn up the fossil fuels. And to an unfortunate extent, as arose in the conversation, it seems like those who are desperate to bring about change are doing the same thing, using using fear and hatred, ill will, aversion as ways to try to bring about change, okay, which ultimately is not all that skillful and is not going to work. So one perspective that arose during the conversation was, well, you know, in terms of death practice, we might need to acknowledge that we as a species are in the process of rendering ourselves extinct as a species. That we are, in fact, making the planet unlivable, and that we may wipe our species off the face of the earth. Nature doesn't care. You know, if you look at the Gaia hypothesis, you know, the idea of the possibility that the entire earth and all life is just one gigantic body, what's one of the things the body does when it gets sick? It runs a fever, you know. It does so for the purpose of killing off the pathogens that are making it sick in the first place, you know. And so looked at from that point of view, perhaps we're the pathogens. On the other hand, to some extent, we're also the antibodies because of the growing effort to heal the planet by controlling the fever. And so one way to look at it is that we all play, to some degree, a kind of a dual role as both pathogens and antibodies. You know, another perspective that was offered up is that, you know, when I went to a state senator's open house about energy policy a few months ago, and she was saying, well, who drove here in a car? You know, who heats their water with natural gas? Well, we all do that, so we're all to blame. And people in the room quickly made it quite clear. We were born into a state of involuntary reliance on a carbon-based energy system that's wiping out life on planet Earth. Okay. We're not responsible for the situation that we were born into. We're responsible for changing the situation. And that way, it's almost like we're in a state of slavery to the energy systems and the economics that control those energy systems. And that it's a life and death struggle to become free of that bondage. And so the demonstrations we're going to start seeing against fossil fuel infrastructure being built around the country, or that's in fact poisoning us right now, can be seen almost like a slave rebellion. You know, it's like, you know, we're not going to be bound this way anymore. I apologize to those of you who likewise think maybe it's not an appropriate topic for Dharma Hall, but it comes straight out of the retreat. I found myself quite inspired in this regard. You know, whether or not you find yourself in agreement with any of the things that I said, you know, in terms of ways to view the situation or whatnot, I think that we're all called upon to use the power of mindfulness that we have developed to at least kindly and carefully consider these matters. And where there is anything more or different that we might be able to do than what we're doing already in order to literally save ourselves and each other. And to do so from a place of letting go. You know, we may be able to save ourselves and other life forms, we may not, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't try. And to do so from a place in the trust and the beneficence of our own true nature. Let's take just a moment and return to the sitting posture. O nobly born, you who are the son or daughter of the Buddha, remember who you are in these times of change. Remember the Buddha who has taken birth in your very own form. Step out of the small self, this body of fear, and rest in generosity and kindness of heart. rests in the dedication, the equanimity and compassion you share with all life. For that is who you truly are. Trust it and rest in your own true nature. Thank you so much for your kind attention. Have a safe journey home.